Are steroids any good at all in pneumonia?
Sore throat caused by a bacteria you may not have heard about before.
Electric fans and overheating.
Can drug therapy help people stop smoking who aren't really quite convinced they're ready yet?
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins, posted on February 20th, 2015. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins and president of the Texas Tech University Health Science Center in El Paso and dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, you served up the idea of reluctant cigarette smoking quitters, let's call it, and varenicline or Chantix. You did that so well that I think we should start with that one. That's in the Journal of the American Medical Association.
I thought this was an interesting study because the U.S. clinical practice guidelines recommend that if a cigarette smoker is going to stop smoking, they just quit abruptly, even though only about 1 in probably 12 individuals say they're able to do that. Instead, we have a lot of people that are willing to kind of dip their toe in the water and say, well, I'm not really quite ready, but what I'll do is I'll kind of reduce the number of cigarettes and then quit over the next several months. And so the question is, do the current drugs we have available help that population actually stop cigarette smoking? This was a randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled, multinational clinical trial with a 24-week treatment period where people either got varenicline, Chantix, or got placebo, and they followed them for the next 28 weeks, so for the course of a year. This is a large study. There were over 1,500 participants. They were willing to reduce their smoking and then make an attempt over the next 3 months. What happened to the people that actually took the varenicline or Chantix? Well, they had a significantly higher abstinence rate, quit smoking, than those who received placebo. And by the way, this was confirmed by measuring carbon monoxide levels. Individuals that took the varenicline, a third of them were able to quit smoking and sustain that for over a year. Those that took placebo, only about 7%.
Pretty amazing, of course, for those who were reluctantly making the attempt to have such great success. Of course, the concern I have to raise is that Chantix or varenicline has had a black box warning on it for a bit here.
There are obviously some concerns that could contribute to some psychiatric disorders, but in this particular study, the number of adverse events was similar for varenicline and for placebo. So I think what you and I recognize is for individuals that are experiencing side effects, they need to stop the medication. But the vast majority of patients in this group did well. Having a third of people that were reluctant said, I'm not really ready to quit now, but maybe over the next 3 months, and a third of them being able to quit smoking and sustain that, that's pretty remarkable.
Oh, it's amazing. I mean, it makes it sound like at least to me that physicians ought to be saying to their patients who are cigarette smokers, why not give this a trial?
This is designed for people that can't stop abruptly, but still have some motivation to say, well, I can do that over the next 3 months if I can begin to reduce the number of cigarettes I smoke.
Okay, so here's my last question. Outside of the potential for psychiatric maladies, what are the other contraindications with regard to varenicline?
Those are the only contraindications. There are obviously side effects, some GI side effects. Compared to placebo, the number of adverse effects was actually not dissimilar from those that received placebo.
Good news. Of course, we just like to get rid of smoking entirely. Have to say that. It wouldn't be me if I didn't. Since we're in the Journal of the American Medical Association, at least here on the East Coast, it is absolutely just so cold right now that this one, I like to study. It tickles me. It makes me realize that, in fact, the temperature is going to change. It's going to get too hot. This is a study that took a look at the efficacy of electric fans in folks who are overheating.
So, Elizabeth, I thought this was a really cool study. Well, actually, it was a hot study. Here's the rationale behind it. A recent Cochrane review suggested there was no evidence that currently exists that either supports or refutes the use of electric fans during heat waves. When the temperature gets so hot, if you're blowing hot air on somebody, the question is, did you actually increase their core temperature and make things worse? So this was a really neat study done on a small number of patients, 8 healthy males. They put them in a room, and they set the temperature either at 97 degrees or 108 degrees, and they began to gradually raise the humidity. For those at 97 degrees, up to 95%. For those at 108 degrees, up to 70%. And they monitored their heart rate and their core temperature. They did it at baseline, and they did it with a fan. And what they discovered was the use of the fans prevented heat-related elevations in heart rate and core temperatures up to approximately 80% humidity when it was 97 degrees. So this is good evidence that the fans can actually provide some benefit to cool patients down when they're at markedly elevated temperatures, even at high humidity.
This, of course, is really good news because we've been seeing such extremes in ambient temperature all over the U.S. in the summertime. And it's fairly inexpensive, so as long as you've got electricity, you can run a fan a lot less expensively than an air conditioner.
The current advice to the public is to stop using fans during heat waves, but this evidence suggests just the opposite. I'm a big fan of this study.
Oh, boo. On that pun, let's complete our survey of the studies we're looking at in JAMA this week and answer the question of, is there a place for steroids in the management of pneumonia?
The use of steroids are immunomodulatory agents. That is, they modulate the immune system. And this has been really controversial, the use of steroids in people that are very sick, either with septic shock or, in this case, severe pneumonia. The studies that seem to suggest a benefit suggest that it may be particularly helpful in people that have severe community-acquired pneumonia and also have a high inflammatory response. This trial specifically targeted patients that had severe community-acquired pneumonia and had a markedly elevated C-reactive protein. Half of these patients received a 5-day course of steroids. The other half received placebo. They had 120 patients participate, and the ones that received steroids, just a 5-day course, had less treatment failure. The treatment failure that most fell out was they were less likely to have progression on their chest x-ray of their pneumonia. We don't really know whether that translates to an improved mortality or not, because the mortality difference wasn't statistically significant. 15% in the placebo group versus 10% in the steroid group. There's a hint it could be a benefit, but the study's just too small to really determine that. It requires larger studies to establish this.
Seems to also suggest that some assessment of the degree of inflammation is necessary in all patients who present with pneumonia.
Only if it's going to change therapy. If you're trying to identify the group that might benefit, you're right, you need to measure this. Now, one of the things I want to highlight is, how often does this occur? Well, I can tell you in this particular trial, it took them 8 years at 5 different centers to accumulate 120 patients. And to do a much larger study, it's almost impossible.
One other thing that I would just like to observe, and then I have a question I'd like to ask you. To me, this suggests that, like so many other clinical entities, it suggests that there's a whole bunch of subpopulations within that group who comprise those patients who get pneumonia.
And in fact, the way we usually do trials is we do the trial, and then we look to see in a post hoc analysis, are there particular people that benefited or benefited more? And that generates the next study, the next hypothesis. Does this subgroup benefit? And that's exactly how this was conducted.
Right. And so I guess that's my question is, I wonder if it would be helpful at all to understand those people who do tend to have more inflammation relative to infection with regard to a multitude of clinical issues, not just pneumonia.
In fact, that's one of the points the editorialist makes. This may not only apply to pneumonia, but may apply to other potentially lethal problems as well, where steroids can be beneficial. Very good point, Elizabeth.
Excellent. Finally, let's turn to this weirdo organism, so-called fusobacteria, and its role in sore throat. That's in Annals of Internal Medicine.
So, Elizabeth, why do you call it a weirdo organism?
Well, it's weird. We don't talk about fusobacterium a whole lot.
All right, and that's why we're talking about it now. Because when you talk about a sore throat or pharyngitis, most people think about a strep throat. In kids, strep bacteria are one of the more common causes. But there was a suggestion in Europe that strep throat actually may not be the more common thing, but actually a different organism called fusobacterium. So this was a study of 312 students aged 15 to 30 years who appeared at a student health clinic with a sore throat. And what they discovered was that fusobacterium was twice as likely to be identified in this group than strep. 20% of individuals with sore throat had fusobacterium, and only about 10% had strep. Why does this matter? We have rapid ways of detecting strep. We don't have a routine way of detecting fusobacterium. It suggests that, at least in this age group, it's a more common cause of pharyngitis.
Wow. Okay, so what about treatment?
It does respond well to antibiotics. You say, well, if you can't really test for it, how do you decide who should receive antibiotics? We actually have what's called a center criteria. We look at 4 different criteria. If they have the criteria, those being fever, lack of a cough, swollen lymph nodes, or exudates, white spots on the tonsils. If you have three or four of those, it's more likely to be bacterial and should be either treated or investigated. If you can't identify group strep, but there's a high suspicion it's bacteria, penicillin is usually very good for Fusobacterium, just as it is for group A strep. One of the things that we are guilty of as prescribing physicians is oftentimes we get the wrong antibiotic. We think that the more expensive, latest, greatest antibiotic is better. But for both of these organisms, penicillin, very effective and also very inexpensive.
Good news. On that note, I'll reveal that I'm going to talk about the electric fans and overheating because I desperately need to think about things that are hot here in Baltimore this week on the blog. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.